We are back, and Amy Dumas has joined us. Amy, thank you so much for being with us, and this should be a very interesting hour or so.
You're making me nervous. I thought I was catching up with an old friend, you tell me I'm in the hands of the fans.
Yeah, you are. You've been in the hands of a lot of fans. You just didn't know it. All those young 14-year-old boys back in the day. But nonetheless, we digress. You know, I'm not interviewing Liberace here. I'm interviewing Lita. I'm so happy about your Hall of Fame induction. So congratulations on that, first of all.
Thank you. Yeah, I wasn't sure if or when that they would decide, the powers that be would decide to hand that over to me. So I was legitimately surprised and excited.
But you got to know that you're not the first female with a tattoo to go into the WWE Hall of Fame.
So you have some inside information. First visible, then, maybe.
It was visible.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't. This is not naughty.
I thought you were going there already.
No, that's coming. It's called foreplay. It's like I have a whole theory about these matches that have no foreplay, and everybody just wants instant gratification without having a match. So I've been blogging about comparing the build of the match to foreplay.
So we'll hang out in a top wrist lock for a minute. So who is this first female that has a tattoo as well?
That's be Mae Young. And Mae Young has had, bless her heart, a little tattoo on her forearm.
She did. You're right.
So I don't
know. An old sailor tattoo.
Yeah. I didn't prepare for that, but it just came up. So, you know, what do you do? Hey, I was on the phone this week, a few days ago, talking to Stone Cold. You know, Stone Cold and Chris Jericho, as you well know, have podcasts here on Podcast One. And Austin led the way, then Jericho came in, then here I came, the little chubby trailer hitch coming around behind and trailing along. But we've been number one in multiple countries on multiple weeks, so I think we're doing okay. But I asked Austin, I said, hey, I'm talking to Amy this week coming up on a podcast. And he says, oh, that would be good. I said, she's just getting back from Nicaragua. And he said, quote, Jesus Christ, Nicaragua, what the hell is she doing there? So my first question in honor of Stone Cold is, how did you pick Nicaragua to spend some of your free time or your off time or your other time?
Why Nicaragua? I have my second home is in Nicaragua, and it's on the beach, the Pacific coast, the southern Pacific coast. My views are to Costa Rica. So topographically speaking, it's the same as Costa Rica. People don't seem to be too scared of Costa Rica. It's mainly all that, landmines and Sandinista stuff, I think, that maybe deter people a little bit.
What the hell? A few mines. Got to move
but
on.
But that's been since the 80s, and it's beautiful there, and I've met so many awesome people there from the country. I've always been an explorer. It's kind of what brought me to become a WWE superstar. But I was exploring around and my retired life, and decided to buy a place there. I wanted to be able to keep up my Spanish chops and have somewhere else just to relax and go surfing.
You're a Renaissance woman, a true Renaissance woman, no doubt about it. When did you find out about the Hall of Fame induction?
They called me, and I was down in Nicaragua. And it was funny because I'd been down there for maybe 2 days, and Steph calls, and she's like, or Steph texts me, and she was like, the office is trying to get in touch with you, they can't get in touch with you. And I was like, that's weird, you know, I mean, you're getting in touch with me just fine. And then I thought, well, they probably called me and I don't have my, you know, calling plan to work intentionally. You know, I was like, I've got my email and iMessage and I'm in touch enough with whatever I need to know. And geez, it's been 48 hours and, you know, I'm not calling back somebody at the office and, you know.
How dare you?
Place is going awry, yeah. So I was like, what? No, I was like, just chilling out here on my hammock, man, at my house in Nicaragua. I mean, she was like, sure, I'll give them a call. And she's like, okay, well, I don't know what it's regarding, but they just want to tell you, ask you something. And I was like,
there's a bunch
right,
of
well,
bunch of
I
guys.
I know that you know what it is, but I can tell the way you phrase that. These guys are
driving all over the road now. They're trying to envision Amy just relaxing, kicking back in a hammock in Nicaragua with that thong, thong stretched tightly above the waistline like the. We used to shoot every Monday night on Raw during the Attitude Era. But B, I digress again. So
we're out of the top wrist lock into like the first, you know, like right before the heat. Is that what just happened? I got my shine.
That's it. That's it. We're telling a story here. And so Stephanie's been trying to, they have been trying to get a hold of you. Stephanie texts you, and then you?
I call my good friend Mark Carano, who had worked at the office, and I hear he's a star on television.
Oh, yeah. He's even changed his hairstyle. He's got that short parted down the middle look. You know, it's the shimp shortcut.
He's got his camera ready look on.
Yes, he does. Yeah, blue blazer.
Male counterpart to the superstars or the divas on television. Mark Carano called me and said he had something to ask me, and it was if I would accept the honor of being in the Hall of Fame. So that was exciting news down there. But it was odd, I'll tell you, because I'm so removed down there in Nicaragua, and my life in general is pretty chill, and I'm just fairly removed. But if there's a way for me to be more removed, it's when I'm down in Nicaragua.
Did the folks in Nicaragua celebrate with you? Did they have a little Amy Day or anything good?
I was by myself. I just checked the times for the tides for my next surf session, and I was like, well, I guess I'll call my mom.
Yeah, and go back to the old hammock.
Yeah, and I called her, and I told her, and she was like, well, that's really great. I went in and checked your mail, and I watered your plants, and everything seems fine over there. And I was like, all right.
You got it made, kid.
Well, great, thanks. But it was like, she seemed excited, but not really. She was like, okay, that's great news. Okay, everything's fine at the house. And I was like, all right, well, see you later. And I was like,
gotta go.
That was that. I guess I'll have to just keep my celebration until the actual night.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, save it up. Hey, what's harder, picking out a dress, writing your speech, or selecting someone to induct you into the WWE Hall of Fame?
Wow, I'd say that's kind of like people saying, what's harder or what's more important, working out or eating right? You know, it all just kind of goes hand in hand.
Yep. Can't win for losing on a speech, take it from me. I wrote one about 10 times, and I even carried it out to the podium and said, screw it. But, you know, I'm not advocating you ever be diversive or of the counterculture like some of us have been known to be or accused of being. And so, you know, because you could wind up on the wrong side of the law.
Hmm. So, well, yeah, if I don't feel good about it, though, that is always option C.
Yeah.
I've just done the first draft. I kind of went through a chronological timeline of who I wanted to thank, which then brings up stories along the way.
Sure.
Does that sound like a decent approach?
Yeah. I think thanking people and getting more people involved is good, because none of us made it without the help of others. And there are a lot of good, I know a lot in my career, a lot of really good people along the way kind of showed me, no, I don't turn there, go over here, or let me, you know, let's give it, you know, they helped me in a lot of different ways, so that's cool. So right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jerry, you're always one of my supporters from the very, not the very beginning, but as soon as we met, back from my first visit up there at Titan Towers.
Titan, we're going to talk about that here in a minute. So writing the speech, write what you want, pick out, you know, whatever you wear is going to look cool. I remember what you wore in that little business suit you wore to my meeting, with our meeting we had you look like a Mary Kay salesperson. You were all dressed.
That's the only business suit I've ever had.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You were a business boy. You were business all the way. And our first meeting, my office in the fourth floor of the Titan Towers. Golly. And now I'm out here in the middle of nowhere in Oklahoma where they filmed the last picture show, I think. I've been sitting here talking to you and gazing out the window from time to time. I have yet to see anything move, wind or cars or humans. I may be in some kind of alternate universe here in Oklahoma. If I don't see you at New Orleans, we've had a hell of a talk so far. So there's that. When did you become a wrestling fan?
Okay. When I became a wrestling fan in kind of an odd way. I went from not being familiar at all, not having any friends or anyone that watched wrestling, to having some friends that watched wrestling. I was like, well, I'm not familiar with that. And then as soon as I watched it, I was a fan, but I was a fan in a way that I was like, wow, that looks like a really cool job. Mm-hmm. And I'd sit and watch it, but I would watch it as almost like I was looking from their perspective, if that's even possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Having no back, history knowledge or anything. And I was like, man, it's like almost relating to them from a, not from a fan perspective, like my friends were cheering and doing stuff, and I was going, that's interesting. That's interesting how that played out. That's interesting how they're portraying this. And
that
was what led me to my quest to want to become a wrestler in the first place. It was almost kind of like a student from day one as opposed to a fan.
Yeah, it's an interesting lifestyle, obviously. I read, kind of ties into this, I think. I've been known for my masterful segues in my lifetime. But I was young then. Back in my day, as Tony Gray would say, at catering, I read.
Back in my day.
Yeah, back in my day. Back in your day, were you a roadie before you got in wrestling? Were you actually a roadie for a rock band or some traveling musical show?
I played in project bands with people, so I was in some touring bands, side project bands, and I also roadied with a couple bands. So the pirate life has been in my veins from a very early age.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you got to do more than be a roadie. And I also, you know, I'd forgotten, because I think they sent me a tape, that you were trained by Dory Funk Jr. for a while. Is that's accurate, right?
That is accurate. Yeah, I think that is where the tape that finally made its way up to Titan was from. He was doing the Funking Conservatory with some of the startups that were already under contract. Then that plan switched, but he started his own, and I was like, well, he knows the formula.
Yeah.
He knows what they want
out
of their talent, and so I think that's probably the best source to go to right now. So I was already with ECW at the time, but I signed up to go train with him on my own dime to just, go as far as I could.
You're a very logical thinking chick with a big tattoo on her arm. You really are. You're deep. I feel like George Carlin now. I think I just had a little moment. When you started watching and you knew that, hey, this thing might be interesting because I kind of like the road and I'm athletic and I think I could do this. I really believe I could do this. You know, and I don't think anybody should put limitations on themselves. Anybody listening? God, for me, to be a fat guy from Oklahoma with a southern accent and 3 bouts of Bell's palsy and have a career, gee, me Christmas. I could do that. If I did that, what can't you do? That's what I like.
Absolutely.
What the hell, So did any one got one talent or one angle or one show really seal a deal as far as you liking the business?
Yeah, absolutely. I was already kind of starting to watch it. I was attaching to people. I was seeing how storylines played out. Rey Mysterio was the number one talent that stuck out to me. I was like, the Mexican wrestlers in general, I liked the mystique behind that, them being able to be so expressive with having their face covered. And Rey Mysterio was just light years above and beyond all of the other wrestlers in being able to portray emotion.
Are you talking about watching him in WWE or are you watching him in Mexico?
Oh, sorry. And they started using him in WCW.
Okay.
So that was the main wrestling that I would watch and be really inspired in a physical way.
Mm-hmm.
And then an emotional way, that very controversial storyline with Kevin Sullivan and Benoit and Nancy, what was going on. And I was like, well, that's not right. Well, she's not supposed to be with him. And why? He looks like he's really mad. He might really be mad. I found myself, I caught them. I'm like, oh, I'm hooked. I'm in,
Yeah, that was some cruel. Hey, that was unfortunately some really weird karma, irony, whatever, in that storyline. Golly.
Oh, absolutely eerie.
Ooh, yeah. Think about it. Ooh, come on. Let's go someplace else. So Rey Mysterio was your guy, and I can see, did you see him do the Hurricanrana for the first time? Because I got a lot of Twitter questions we're going to get to as we go on here from our loyal Twitter followers. You have yours, I have mine, and we have more than we probably deserve. But nonetheless, people were wondering if you were influenced by Ray and regarding the Hurricanrana, or the Lita Carana, as I tried to call it some Monday nights.
Yeah, absolutely. And many, many fans after that called it that for many years because of that. But yeah, definitely. Ray was the first person that I saw. And from there, anything in general, because I am very logical and kind of have an pretty insatiable thirst for knowledge. So if I see something I like or something that interests me, such as Ray doing the Hurricanrana,
yeah.
I'm going to go find out where he did it, where that comes from, who else is doing it, what it, you know. So from there, I'm watching countless hours of Mexican wrestling footage and tapes and anything I can get my hands on. And that's what led me to go down to Mexico to start training, because I was like, this is not just like, you know, a gimmick. These Mexican wrestlers are really from Mexico. You know, as far as I know, you know, there could be some Russian in the mask under there, but they're just calling them Mexican wrestler. And as I was doing my research, I was like, no, they're really from Mexico. So if that's what I want to learn, I guess that's where I should go.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that cuts to the chase. Pretty smart thinking. So you went to Mexico and you started training. Now, tell me this story, because it's just strange to me. And strange may not be the best word, but, you know, hell, I'm not really actually a broadcast journalist. I'm a wrestling announcer. There just aren't a lot of need for wrestling announcers these days in my world. You go to Mexico. Do you go alone to Mexico?
Yes.
And, okay, then when you got, did you already have a contact there before you left that was going to help you along, or did you go there cold turkey?
I went there cold turkey.
God.
I was told that that Lucha Libre was bigger than American football, you know, in Mexico, and all I need to do is just get there, and it's, you know, that's all anyone's ever going to be talking about, and people are going to, there's just going to be wrestling matches all over the place, and you're just going to find it once you get there. So whoever said that, I was like, okay.
So you believe that?
Yeah.
Yeah, sound like you know, I've had those magic mushrooms before. You think crazy stuff. Well, nonetheless, I'm kidding you. That took a lot of courage, because I know we went to Mexico City to do Raw, because I was actually in segment 11, which we're going to talk about here in a minute, about your segment 11. I was actually in one of my segment 11s, because, you know, big stars like me are so gifted athletically and have such, you know, appealing physiques. We are in segment 11 on multiple occasions. It's multiply organic when a guy like me gets in segment 11. And we go to Mexico City to do Raw, and they don't want us to leave our hotel. They put us in a hotel. They actually have extra security there. We never left the hotel. I flew from the airport to the airport, obviously, duh. Drove to the hotel in a car that was waiting on me. Stayed in the hotel till I went to Raw. I did my little gig at Raw as John Cena's sidekick tag team partner. And then back to the hotel, and that was it. And the next day I flew home. So they said, oh, it's dangerous. They'll take your Rolex. Oh, it's not real. I got it from Plowboy Frazier. No, it is real. But, you know, then you're down there by yourself, for God's sakes. I can't even imagine that. Was it calmer then, or did you just have not know? Was it?
I think I just had to, a bunch of kid power. There was actually a government advisory, like about 4 days before I left to go to Mexico, that said no tourists should go down to Mexico. You know, something had just happened, some, you know, big drug thing or government thing or something.
Yeah.
And they said no tourists should go down to Mexico, only if you have official business that you'll be escorted by official, you know, official security.
Official masked man of the wrestling Lucha Libre.
Right. All everybody else should stay. And I was like, huh, you know how long it took me to save up to get this ticket? You know, I'm not going to give up my ticket. I'm not going to get a refund on it. You know, there's going to be change fees involved and all this. I can't do that. So I disregarded that warning. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Kids, there's what you learn here. Never allow a ticket, a non-refundable ticket, not to be used, even if the government tells you your life may be in danger. So that's what you did, right?
That's what I did, yeah.
That's what you did, because you believed. And how long were you in Mexico total training, and would you do it again?
Oh, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. I was down there the first time for a month or so. No, the first time for 6 weeks I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
And then by about the end of the 6 weeks was when I was finally getting, you know, making connections and figuring things out. I mean, earlier than that. But and then they I wouldn't go home, because they kept saying, well, you should just be a beer model or something. And I was going to the matches. That was 4 days a week. They had matches. And then I was on a judo team down there as
well. What the hell's a beer model?
Well, I said, no, I want to get in there and I want to do this. I said, you know, maybe we can trade maybe some training for for beer bottle, for ring card girl or whatever.
But okay, I got you.
I want to get in there and do it.
Yeah.
And so finally they believed me after 6 weeks of not missing a show. You know, four times a week I was there in the front row.
Were you making any money?
Oh, no. I was just down
you're
there.
You're just down there on savings.
Yeah. Well, and then
that's scary.
They said, okay, well, if you come back, we'll hook you up with training. And so then I went back, and then I saved up again, and then I went down for about 3 weeks and just got an intro, just got my crash course into wrestling there at the CMLL school. And then there I met several foreigners who are Americans or Canadians telling me where a lot closer places are that I could go to further my training.
Yeah. Where'd you go after that, after Mexico?
After Mexico, there was an NWA in Cherry Hill, New Jersey anniversary show.
Ah.
I went there, and then from there, I met several regional, you know, independent workers and ex-superstars and everything there, and found some training in North Carolina, found some training in Chicago. Just, you know, I would, anywhere I could go, I would just, you know, if I could get there in time for the match, I would go, and we'd get there early and train around in the ring and just, you know, keep baby stepping ahead.
Early 20s, right, then?
Yeah.
Hey, tell people what it's like to come into a meeting with good old JR back in the talent relation days when you're looking for work. Was I a turd? Was I a tool? Was I a bad administrator? Because I never really remember everything specifically. You know, someday when I write a book, I'm going to have to call you guys, like, you know, Uncle Zeb on some show. Not Dutch, not Zeb Coulter, but some Uncle Joe, you know, in Hooterville. Somebody
that's how I feel. Writing the speech, I've had fans remind me. I was like, "What are your favorite Lita moments?" And they're reminding me of things. I'm like, "Oh yeah."
Yeah,
so,
I know.
So yeah, I can tell you what I remember, and we can piece these life stories together.
Yeah,
I think.
Good. Thank you so much. You helped me out there.
But no, I you guys, it's funny, you know, as being hired and seeing in all of these upper management in different states of casual, or, you know, you get to talking on a personal level. But no, at that time, I really believed you and Bruce Pritchard as a very authoritative team that kind of held my future in the palms of your hand. They're, you know, like a very, like, a straight-up business team. You pulled it off.
Yeah, Bruce was. But I was a serious one of the team.
No, you were the straight man for sure.
And Bruce did what he did best. Bruce was Bruce liked creative better, you know. So he soon vamoosed from talent relations, and I assumed the reins to the runaway train of eight horses, wild horses running.
Yeah, you were the masthead of the Misfit Toys big ship.
The crappiest job in the history of the business is being in charge of talent relations. Trust me, kids. Real quick thought, a lot of fans ask about, and I forgot about this a little bit, S.A. Rios. Was that how your first book, S.A., with you and S.A. Rios, or you were his valet, or what was that? I can't remember.
I definitely remember that one. I was a fan of his. I watched him down in Mexico when I was down there training. He was Mr. Aguila there, and he had worked some with the Super Astros show as Papi Chulo. And they wanted to repackage him, and decided to put us together, which was about my, you know, dream come true as far as me, you know, coming down to Mexico and then getting to do this Lucha Libre-influenced thing to come onto the scene.
But little did you know, it wasn't your dream come true. It was still yet to be born.
It was over and over again. It still was.
But he was a colorful guy. Didn't he have that fur coat or that?
Well, that was when he was in Super Astros. He had the fur coat, and then we just did the all red thing.
Yeah. That was how it all kind of got started, and all that. I think that's just good that it evolved. I got some Twitter questions for you, and I really did my best to call through them, but some of them were too provocative not to use. So, how important was the leadership in the women's locker room during your early days of the Attitude Era? In WWE?
Huh, that's a pretty random question you don't get asked every day. It's funny that, you know, as far as what I do know from wrestling now, or I mean, it's been quite a while since I left at this point. Mm-hmm. But there was a very defined pecking order in the locker room when I got there, and it was very understood, and it wasn't, it was deserved, so you didn't feel as though it you know, snotty or anything. Like, it's just the way it was, and it worked, and you were respectful of everybody's space, and you knew that you were the new kid, and you put your bags in the corner, and, you know, and it just helped, you know. And then because a level of a pecking order and a level of respect was there that came along with experience, then they were also, you know, you showed them that you respected that. So then when you went to go ask for advice or you asked the question, you're going to get, you know, more likely a helpful answer than somebody, you know, potentially feeding you the wrong information because you put your makeup all over their stuff, or you laid your costume on top of their suitcase, or, you know, whatever. These things that are essentially no big deals, but it's what it shows that it does. It shows a lack of respect for people that were there before you.
So no issues with that. Would see, some people in today's marketplace would consider that hazing. I don't. I think so.
No, I don't either. Because the thing is, you know, it's like common courtesy is not so common.
I agree. It's a rite of passage. You know, it's a unique business. We got to admit that. There is a fraternity in it. We know that, and it becomes your life for a while, not just your job. And speaking of that, what were your thoughts on the another Twitter question? The Matt Hardy Edge TV storyline. The Twitter person wants to know if it was too close to home.
Oh, absolutely, it was. It was very hard to come to work every day. It was probably the darkest period of my life. Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow. Did you express that to anybody? Did you tell me that? Or did you just do your job?
Yeah. I made my bed. I had to lay in it. I remember girls in the locker room going, "Oh, you look so great. You're so skinny." I'm like, "Yeah, I have an ulcer. I don't eat. I'm miserable."
Wow. And then TV and having to perform and go to the ring in front of all the fans just made it even exasperated, the whole situation.
Oh yeah, I mean, think about. I mean, I feel like I was walking my dog on my day off, and somebody would open their window up and yell, "You screwed Matt." You know, I mean, there was no escaping it anywhere. It was pretty awful.
Now that becomes really freaky. You know, that would be like me seeing Woody Harrelson and asking him how the stab wound in his stomach is healing from True Detective.
I'm not there yet, so don't, I'm only on episode 5.
Oh, so. God. Well, I didn't say he died.
Okay, right. No, please don't tell me.
Hey, it's a hell of a, you're going to love, I'll tell you this, you are going to love episodes 5-8. So I said, we'll stop there with that. Did you have any second thoughts on the creative when they did the Bed in the Ring live sex show for Raw?
Oh, I had 8,000 thoughts, but they weren't going to mean anything because once Vince has his mind set on something, there was no option there. Other than leaving the building, there was no option.
Yeah. Hey, it could have been worse. You could have had to rehearse with him.
Okay, all right. Just way to look on the bright side.
Well, you know, it's just an idea. This is a comedy. It's my attempt at comedy. Somebody on a writing team will tell Vince, "Vince, you know what JR said on his podcast?" Then the story will go. So here we go. So, when I saw that on the script that Lawler and I are going to broadcast a live sex show, I knew that he was more like Larry Flint than I, because he's the king. But I was just trying to figure out how do you call a live sex show other than lay out?
Just a lot of laying out.
Lay out, God damn it. How many rehearsals did that take? Did they bring the bed to the ring that day and all that?
I think my memory is a little hazy here. It's kind of we're going to have other people piece that one together.
It's not that important. It was a lot. The live sex show came off. It got a good rating, didn't it? Or did it? I thought it did.
It absolutely did. I don't even know if it's been beat since. It was an extremely high rating.
High rating. Well, there you go, kids.
So, I mean, you know.
Live sex show does it
every
time.
There's that. And, you know, And as much as you want to argue sometime, the boss usually knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
you know,
so. He does. He does, yeah. Absolutely. He gave me a black hat, and it's been my gimmick ever since. And I've always said, if you got no talent, you got to have a gimmick. So I got a black hat. It's easy. Easy to figure out. Don't overthink this stuff. It's crazy. I asked Trish this, and in general, looking back on the past, if you could, you know, retrace your steps, what advice, or you know, retrace your steps, but what advice would you give a young woman in the business today about dating a wrestler? For some reason, Twitter people want to know what you guys think about dating wrestlers.
I mean, I do feel to an extent it can be unavoidable because your life is just, you're just inside this bubble and you have these people around you that are also in this bubble and it's very hard to get outside of it because
you're
on the road 300 days a year. You're living this really crazy life that can be really hard for a normal person to even relate to or to identify with.
Yep.
So I absolutely understand how it happens, but it usually ends a little messy.
I saw on Discovery Channel the other night where a man gets horny every 30 minutes. So if you were in a bubble with a man and you work with him every day, you guys working 300 days a year or so, close to it, give or take, I get it, folks. Don't get crazy in the dirt sheet now, but you actually work 300 days a year because they travel, it all counts. You're gone from home. Trust me, 300 days ain't too damn far off. So you're with this, these guys. You can't help it, really, unless you're married, to create a relationship. Who else are you around, for God's sakes? You know, I used to talk to talent about their wrestling relationships. God almighty, I felt like Dr. Effing Phil.
For sure. Yeah, your talent relations.
Yeah, I heard of all. He's broke my heart, and I found these pictures on his phone, and he's bought his girlfriend a new boob job, and God, wait a minute, he what? You know, hold on, do I need to know this really? Is this really important for me to hear? It's crazy. So, in any event, let's move on to something more positive. They end up crazy. Good statement. Sometimes they end up crazy. Is there any experience that you had? I get this all the time, and I hate this question, so I'll ask you because I'm a sadist, I guess.
Oh, good.
Yeah, do you have a favorite moment? Just an absolute, this was absolute without a question, shout out, this was my favorite moment in WWE. I can't answer that question.
No, I mean, I could rattle off 10, you know what I mean? But no,
I can't either. That means I had a great time there. I made great money there. I made retirement money there. As my buddy tells me all the time, JR, there ain't nothing like mailbox money. And he's right. So we both had great experiences there. You did well there, I know. And, you had not just in the ring, but, I mean, you financially did well. So that's good. Did you have a favorite opponent? That's hard to answer because you think you're going to piss everybody off that you don't mention.
No, it's not that at all. It's especially, too, because I had so much integral work with the guys that weren't technically opponents, the people that I worked with,
mm-hmm.
that's like, you know, all in one category. But as far as one-on-one matches, it would be Trish.
Yeah. That's what most people remember. You know, did you realize how groundbreaking it was when you and Trish closed Raw in the coveted main event spot? Did you think at that time, hey, man, we've done pretty good here.
We knew that day when they told us. We knew what a big deal that was, and we also knew what big shoes we had to fill, and you know, but also at the same time felt like we had the knowledge and talent development. You know, our characters were able to hold that spot too. We knew what a big deal it was, but and respected the spot that it was, but we're ready to go out there and do it.
I tell people this all the time. You know, you're getting cast in a role in a very physical, fictional presentation. Your key word here, folks, cast in a role. So you get cast as Lita and Trish did in their rivalry in a specific role. Then you must go out and execute it to the level that people want to see more of it. People at that point wanted to see so much of it, it closed Raw with a great rating and a great groundbreaking accomplishment. Then you broke ground again, as I think this is right, in the first ever Divas cage match with Lisa, right?
Yeah.
That's a hell of a deal there too. Women bounce. I won't tell you this. I've seen a lot of crazy things in my time. You know, wrestling bears and you know donkey basketball games. Seriously. It wasn't in Tijuana, by the way. It was for a fundraiser. I felt uncomfortable calling the cage match with the women in it, and maybe it's just the old guy in me. I don't know. But I felt for you guys. Well, that cage just doesn't care what your gender is.
No, it doesn't. Unforgiving, as you've said several times, that is real.
And you did that. I thought that was pretty cool. Someone asked me to quiz you about the storyline involving yourself, Kane, and Snitsky. And I didn't answer them back, but I wrote myself a note. I forgot this one. What the hell is that about? You, Kane, and Snitsky.
I gave Snitsky his catchphrase for his entire career, which was, "It wasn't my fault."
Oh.
When he smashed my baby with a chair,
oh,
and I had a miscarriage, oh, with my demon spawn inside.
My God, the demon spawn's death caused by Snitsky's inadvertent shot. Ladies and gentlemen, the ultimate soundbite and an actuality from the victim, Amy, who lost her demon sperm. God Almighty, how could I have forgotten that? That was great.
Maybe you blocked that one out.
I might have blocked it out. Could be blocking there. Moonsault, your idea, because it really became your signature move. Did you get that from the Mexican guys, or was this something that you just wanted to do as a female?
I got that from the Mexican guys, I just was already doing that on the indies, and it was also one of the moves that S.A. Rios was already doing, and when we were doing the mimicking thing when I was out there with him, it just became the move. And it was the easiest thing to hit when, you know, a lot of those moves require somebody being really knowledgeable for you to base them, for them to base you or to interact with you. You don't want it to rely on somebody else to mess up your finish. It's on me, you know, so let me just do something. You just lay there and I'll do the rest.
Boy, what a life that is. Hear that, guys? Just lay there and she'll do the rest. It'll be a moonsault from the top rope. And it won't...
That was there. I just threw that out there. And I did not mean to, but you had to take that one, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was good. That's good. You threw it out there. You know, you were fearless. But you didn't come out of it unscathed. You were out a long time, the bad neck.
Oh, yeah. Broke it in three places. That one was pretty rough. Broke my neck in three places, as well as tore everything in my knee at pay-per-view. And I was out, I don't know, about 7 months with that. Those are the two main ones.
And that's enough. That's enough. Hey, look, I have never been a big fan, overly a big fan, of intergender matches. And it's just old school. I don't hate them. But you were, man, you kind of made your reputation in some of those intergender matches, did you not?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you and King, also being more the traditionalist, were not a big fan of our intergender matches, but those were definitely some of my favorite matches that we've ever done. There's just so many elements. You can do sexual elements, comedy elements, and then you can also be a real badass interacting with the dudes on a level that you don't normally get to interact.
What's more fun, a baby face or heel?
They're both different. I loved really being a babyface, but it was fun for me at the end of my career to be a heel because you're really leading the match and you're dictating the pace and you're in control of what's happening. And so that was really, it was fun for me to do, and it was fun for me to be able to use the knowledge that I had soaked up along the way to be able to do all that.
You know, when I first got in the business and I made my first road trip in the territory back in the mid-70s, a guy said, when you get to Baton Rouge, stay at such and such hotel because that's where the heels stay. Because back in those days, you know, the baby faces and the heels had to stay at completely different hotels. So in the territory where a lot of guys stayed, they rented a weekly rate at this hotel in Baton Rouge. He said, stay at this hotel because the heels have more fun. So I didn't really know what that meant, but I soon learned I can see being a heel was a very if you like to express yourself and you like theatrics, being a wrestling heel is pretty damn cool.
Well, sure, and then I guess in public or anything else you do, you just can be like, oh, I was just in character.
That's right, yeah. Ribbon on a square, known for our business. Who came up with the exposed thong thing? I wrote that myself, actually, because I remember the...
You just make up some Twitter handle. You're like, these people want to know.
Yeah, I admitted this one. I admitted that I admitted the good one. Who came up with the idea of the exposed thong? Was that your?
I did. It was just I needed an accessory to match my top because I knew I was going to be wearing these baggy pants. So yes. I just needed something to you know, something to make my baggy pants with my big knee pads under so I could do my moonsault and keep my knees protected, and I needed to make it a little more feminine.
I got you. Hey, did you have to get that approved by the home office?
I did not. I remember I wrestled my first match with that new style, and King came up after he said, you know, that was a really good match, but your underwear was sticking out the whole time.
Yeah,
no, I know. I did that on purpose. It matched my top.
Good job, Jerry. What do you want to do then? Do you want them or something? Do they offer you a crown or a signed T-shirt from Graceland for a pair of your underwear? You know, the king is Larry Flint. I'm telling you. You got to watch that guy. Hey.
I'm not his type. The tattoo just really threw him off.
Yeah, really. And I always said that once his girlfriends reached the age for their driver, where their car insurance went down, which I think is 25, that he started having a declining interest in them at 25. And that was just my own assumption. It's not, ladies and gentlemen, a scientific test. It is only an assumption by one individual. If you could have one match, one more match, would you have one more match, by the way, if it was the right deal? Would you have one more match? Could you? Would you want to? What's the story there?
Yeah, I mean, if it was the right deal and the right time, yeah, I could. I feel great physically. I'd want it to be something that I would be able to have fun doing.
Yeah, like WrestleMania, right? I mean, why would you want to do it on the third Thursday of April of Monday Night Raw? I'd want to do it at WrestleMania or something big, SummerSlam.
Something big. I would go for one more match, yeah.
Yep, something big. When you decided to leave the WWE, was it burnout, injuries, combination thereof, or just you wanted to go on a new adventure? You were done.
A little of the first and a little of the last. No, my body felt fine. It was just that I felt as though I'd accomplished everything there was to accomplish as a woman in my career, what I set out to do. I felt like it did. And at that point, I could continue to do that. I got to know how to navigate my job pretty well at that point, and it wasn't that difficult. It was difficult. It hurt. It hurt getting hit in the face and the travel, you know, but I just become used to the schedule. I knew how to do it, and I could continue to do that for a paycheck. But I didn't get into the business for a paycheck. I got in for an adventure, and it was an adventure, and I saw what that was, and I just decided I'd rather fall flat on my face on the next adventure and just see what was out there, because it does take up so much of your time. I was missing my friends' weddings and babies being born and all this stuff that I was inside my bubble. And so I just wanted to, you know, go on the other side.
Hey, you know, the thing about it is that tomorrow's not guaranteed, by the way. You know, I'm not sounding like an evangelist here, but the fact of the matter is tomorrow's not guaranteed. Today is where you are, and you can't change yesterday. So, you know, the bottom line is that it's time, and I can relate to that situation. How's the band doing? The Luchagors. I love that name, by the way. I should get a Luchagor T-shirt.
I guess we'll see if I could dig any up. That chapter has already come to a close as well. We did three U.S. tours, three European tours.
Wow.
Again, something I was interested in before I wrestled. I was playing in bands, so it was something I just wanted to say that I did and didn't want to know what if I had taken this other path and been
That's
in this
cool.
band.
You play the bass, right?
I play the bass. In the band, I would play bass and guitar to write the music, and then in the band, I just sang live.
Wow. Man, you have... If I'm a producer, you know, if I'm a television producer and I have an ounce of creativity in my body, I would be beating down your door to say, hey, we need to do this reality show, because what you do is not, you ain't June Cleaver here. You know, you're a different breed of cat, and I'd like to know more about the cat. You know, are you going to write a book? Are you going to do any? You going to document this life that you've had? Because it is pretty damn unique.
It is. You know, they had me do my book when I broke my neck in 2002, which was really just the beginning of my career, and I've got so much more life stories that have happened since. So
man, if you're interested in seriously shopping a book, because that's what I'm doing right now with some people, I would really endorse anybody I talk to at least engage you in a conversation to talk about, because the independent woman side of you is absolutely phenomenal. That you try things. You have the courage to try things, get outside your comfort zone. And I said a million times that people that live in their comfort zone are starting to perish. Because if you ain't living, you're dying. It's real simple.
I do too. I don't know any other way.
There you go. There you go. Listen, I'm proud of you. Thank you for taking time to be on our program. You're a uniquely talented woman. And I think it just has, an enviable, independent spirit. And I hope that other young women that listen to this or people that hear this will suggest young women listen to it, because it just shows if you got the courage and the willpower that just about anything is possible, because you've kind of shown that to me.
Well, and yeah, and guys can listen too, and then they can also go out and do things too. I'm not exclusive to females.
Well, that's another story for another. That's a whole other show, ladies and gentlemen.
And I'm laying them out for you. What am I doing here? I need to make some more bullet points.
Yeah, you know, you laid me some softballs up that I used to do for Lawler, and I just didn't. Some of them I just backed away from. But look, I enjoyed the visit. It's a little irreverent, and I want to keep it that way. It's shooting the breeze. I like that. Congratulations, and I'll see you down in New Orleans.
All right, JR. Sounds good. Thanks.